In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. About 25 years ago, after nearly another generation of preparation preceding it, and after quite a bit of debate and consternation, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park and the environment around it. And this is the point at which I'm sure you're scratching your heads wondering, well, where is he going to go with this? Stick with me. And in the course of those 25 years almost, beginning with just 14 wolves that were introduced, the restoration of this element of the ecosystem, of the balance of that park and its surrounding environment, has had a remarkable impact. It had been almost 70 years since the wolf population of that area was hunted almost to extinction. And the reintroduction of these, there were some consequences that were expected, that the deer and elk population that had grown beyond what the park could sustain were thinned, that these herds, being prey for the wolves, were reduced. But beyond that, that both the reduction of these herds and the change of their patterns, that they no longer fed in the open areas where they were easy prey, and the riverbanks along the waterways that flowed through that area, the trees that had been grazed to nubs were able to grow up, forested areas began to fill in, the grassy areas along the riverbank no longer trampled, filled in and strengthened the riverbanks. This in turn had consequences of the restoration of certain species. The beavers who depended upon the habitat that those trees provided returned as well, those populations having been almost eliminated from the park. They would dam up the riverways and create habitats for fish and other species. The wolves competing with the coyotes allowed for a resurgence of small prey in the park, which in turn had the effect of providing support for birds of prey that again were disappearing. And the follow-on consequences of these, even to the point of reshaping the direction of the waterways of Yellowstone and the landscape of it, all of this because of 14 animals released into this ecosystem. And with the eyes of faith, you can't help but marvel at it, at the incredible beauty and complexity of God's design, that this one simple thing, this one simple element, has such a transformative power, and the balance given in God's wisdom. And we see this throughout creation, from the smallest, almost unobservable scale, the ordering of things beyond even measurement or observation, to the grand scale of the universe, from the idea that we've grown accustomed to, I think, that creation is so ordered that we can observe and predict today and consequences will follow, and the same observations are reliable tomorrow. That the rules of the universe don't, and of creation don't shift from day to day. That gravity pulls us towards the earth today and might push us away from it tomorrow. That all creation is ordered by the wisdom of God, even that gives us the grounds for the reliability and predictability of the flourishing of empirical science that we've seen in the last several centuries. All depends on confidence in that thing, that God has ordered his creation well. And this contribution, this observation, that with the eyes of faith we see and draw from it the lesson of God's providence. That God has provided well for his creation and continues to provide. In this passage from St. Matthew's Gospel, we hear of Jesus' response to the death of John the Baptist. John, who had proclaimed his coming, and for his prophetic voice, gave his life, was imprisoned and executed. And Jesus hears of this and withdraws in a boat to a deserted place by himself, and the crowds come following. He provides for their need, that he heals their sick and delivers those afflicted. And some saw this and began to understand the lesson of God's providence, but for many, well, like most of us, sometimes the lesson is slow to sink in. So his disciples see this crowd that's gathered and they look with a bit of anxiety. And they come to Jesus and say, "You're going to have trouble if you don't do something about this. There's too many. Send them off to get something to eat." They see first the problem. And the first answer is, well, you send the problem away. Get the problem at a good, safe distance. Let trouble worry about itself. But Jesus puts it to them, well, give them some food yourselves. No, the answer isn't detach ourselves from the problem. But why don't you fix it? So often that's our second response if we don't go the way of, well, ignore it and it'll go away. Then we're tempted to, I've got this. It would all be fixed if I could just have the reins. If everybody would just do what I know is best, and I've told them on Facebook, so there's no reason they shouldn't understand. If everybody would just do what I know is best, then it will all be straightened away. Fix it yourself. And I would love to have seen how big the eyes of the disciples got when Jesus said that to them, give them some food yourselves. Looking at this crowd of 5,000 men and their families, there is not enough. And there are some who say, well, the answer to this is that, well, everybody just decided that they would be generous and everybody opened their own lunch boxes and found out there was enough. They all shared their meals with what they had brought and just didn't tell anybody about. And my first response is, did you not hear the story? Were you not listening? 5 loaves and 2 fishes are all we have here, they say to him. And it's not, well, they didn't do their math right. They didn't move the decimal point over, and it turns out they actually had 5,000 loaves. No, there was not enough. The plain point of the story is, by their own efforts, they weren't going to fix this problem. And they had to depend upon him. And that's whether it's sooner or later. And certainly we ought to use the gifts and blessings God has put at our disposal and use them well, and use them diligently, and not waste the day that God gives us each time we get up in the morning, and not squander the opportunity given. But again, sooner or later, we all come up a bit short. This will not be done by my efforts alone or yours. The providence of God has to be good for me. And so Jesus has them recline and blesses and breaks the loaves. And somebody asked me, well, it doesn't say anything about the fishes. He broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. Well, that's a very significant thing in Jewish custom, that from the meal, the ritual of the meal begins with the blessing and is set in motion by the breaking of the bread. Nobody eats until the master of the table breaks the bread. This is tangentially. One of my professors pointed out, talking about the passage of the encounter with the disciples on the road to Emmaus after Jesus is risen. He walks with them on the way, but they don't know that it's him. And when they get to the place where they're stopping, they say, come and eat with us. Then he says the blessing, and he breaks the bread, and they see him, they recognize him in the breaking of the bread. So my instructor said, well, what happened there? He had said the blessing, and it's... You're not supposed to say anything once the blessing is said until the bread is broken. Finally, there was silence. They shut their mouths and they listened. And there they saw him, and there they received him. And I wonder how many of the disciples who were there that day, of those 5,000 plus who were fed, some of them, as St. John says in his gospel following his account of this miraculous multiplication, you followed me because you ate your fill and were satisfied. The lesson stopped at a full belly. But I'm sure there were some, when he came to his cross, who remembered this day when there was not enough, when what they had was exhausted. And he fed them from abundance, with plenty left over. I'm sure there were some who looked at the cross and said, well, this can't be it. There has to be more. Who, despite the evidence, who, despite what their own eyes told them, believed that there would still be life. Believed that there would still be hope. I think one of the tasks in life is hanging on to that lesson of providence, that lesson that God provides when I see him at the end of my rope, when it is apparent that what I've got will not do, what I have will not suffice, that God will have some purpose and some way in it. It may not be the end and the purpose that I'm looking for. That may be part of the instruction of that shortage. But God will provide. He has not fallen asleep at the switch. He has not stepped out on the job. And so holding that lesson of providence, and again, I think you get to a certain point in life and with some sense of reflection and self-awareness, we can spot certain times that, boy, if this was just on my effort, I'd be lost. If this was just to my purpose, I'd be a mess. There but for the grace of God. And that habit of seeing the work of providence when it is perhaps not expected, when it is seemingly not possible, and holding on to that lesson for that realization that I did not come into this life by my own doing, by my own choosing. I have not come to the grace of God by my own work, but by His election and call. Was I baptized, and by His election and call am I fed with this bread of life? In His wisdom and providence, He will sustain me. And in His goodness, He will call me and give me that blessing without end, that gift without measure. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.